I am James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great.
This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. As the U.S. approaches Tuesday's all-important midterm elections, many look ahead to the presidential election of 2024. On a campaign stop in Florida, former U.S. President Donald Trump teased he's close to making an announcement about running again.
In order to make our country successful, safe, and glorious, I will probably have to do it again, but stay tuned.
AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has more on campaigning the last weekend before Election Day.
Many analysts have said it depends on who turns out in force that will determine which party has control of Congress after the midterm elections. Vice President Kamala Harris in Chicago says Democrats have been keeping their promises to try to help lower-income families, a mandate given by voters 2 years ago.
When you vote, it's kind of like putting in your order. This is what I want from my country.
Former President Donald Trump, campaigning in Miami, says it's the border.
To stop the invasion on our southern border. It's an invasion, like a military invasion.
President Biden, his wife, former Presidents Obama and Trump have been on the road all weekend pushing for candidates in some of the key battleground races. I'm Jackie Quinn.
British Prime Minister Rishi on Sunday night arrived in Egypt for the COP27 climate summit. Sunak reversed a decision to skip the conference that had drawn criticism at home and abroad. Meanwhile, a UN report warns of a record rise in sea levels as world leaders gathered for the climate conference. But the absence of the world's biggest polluters means many are doubtful the talks could result in any major deals to cut emissions long term. This is VOA News. It's Monday in North Korea, where forces said they would respond to joint exercises by the United States and South Korea with, quote, sustained, resolute, and overwhelming, end quote, military measures, its state media reported. The warning came following a spate of missiles tests by North Korea last week, including four ballistic missiles Saturday, while the United States and South Korea conducted their biggest ever Air Force drills. U.S.-South Korea joint drills have long sparked strong reactions from North Korea, which sees them as rehearsals for an invasion. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Sunday said that if Iranian drones were not supplied to Russia, Ukraine would already be, quote, closer to peace, end quote. Zelensky said he discussed the increase of pressure on Iran in a telephone call with the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen. This is as the Washington Post reports the United States is privately encouraging Ukraine to signal an openness to negotiate with Russia. The U.S. State Department said Moscow was escalating the war and did not seriously wish to engage in peace talks. The newspaper cited unnamed sources as saying the request by American officials was not aimed at pushing Ukraine to the negotiating table, but a calculated attempt to ensure Kyiv maintains the support of other nations. Pakistan's former prime minister says a protest march towards the capital will resume on Tuesday, despite his being wounded by gunfire last Thursday. AP correspondent Naomi Shannon has more.
Speaking from his wheelchair in Shaukat Khanum Hospital, the ex-leader, who was wounded by gunshot in an apparent attempt on his life, called out to his supporters.
Judicial commission jo sabse pehle kaam.
He demanded an investigation into the shooting and the resignation of three powerful members of the government and the military whom he alleges were involved in staging the attack on him. Khan was ousted from office in April in a no-confidence vote in parliament. He organized a march to pressure Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif's government to hold early elections. His protest march was peaceful until the attack, which killed one of his supporters and wounded him and 13 others, and has raised concerns about growing political instability in Pakistan. He has since been discharged from hospital and moved to his home in Lahore. I'm Naomi Shannon.
Israel's outgoing prime minister has issued a plea for national unity days after he was defeated in national elections by the former premier Benjamin Netanyahu. In a memorial ceremony for the assassinated prime minister Yitzhak Rabin, outgoing prime minister Yair Lapid warned of the deep divisions plaguing the country after the fifth election since 2019. By remote, Diane Roberts, VOA News.
Today is Monday, November 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Russian forces increase strikes in eastern Ukraine targeting energy infrastructure.
Ukrainian authorities set the region, recently a target of Moscow's annexation and declaration of martial law, is seeing worsening conditions for residents and its defending army.
Abortion remains a key issue heading into U.S. midterm elections on Tuesday.
So in general, Republican administrations have imposed the policy, and then when they come into office, Democratic administrations have rescinded the policy. And we've seen that again probably over the last 40 years.
And delegates at UN's COP27 summit agree to discuss compensation for poor countries due to climate change. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Sunday that Russia is suffering heavy losses in continuing, quote, fierce attacks on, quote, in Ukraine's eastern Donetsk region and is preparing new assaults on Ukrainian energy infrastructure. This as the Kremlin increased strikes in eastern Ukraine and continued to target power and water supplies. Associated Press correspondent Naomi Shenan reports.
Ukrainian authorities set the region, recently a target of Moscow's annexation and declaration of martial law, is seeing worsening conditions for residents and its defending army. Governor of Donetsk Oblast, Pavlo Kirilenko, says the attacks have almost completely destroyed the area's power plants and that daily shelling has destroyed the region. Moscow continues to target Ukraine's energy infrastructure, causing power shortages across the country. Kyiv and surrounding regions are scheduled to have hourly blackouts to conserve the energy that they have as cold weather approaches. According to President Zelensky's office, between Saturday and Sunday, Russia launched 4 missiles and 19 airstrikes, impacting more than 35 villages in 7 regions. I'm Naomi Shannon.
Anti-government protests are set to resume Tuesday as former Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan leads thousands of his followers to the capital after recovering from an assassination attempt. His supporters staged nationwide protests this weekend, blocking key roads and at times clashing with security forces. Khan was shot on Thursday as he waved to crowds from his convoy. The protest march is calling for early elections and the resignation of Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif. Tensions are high as the government has placed the police and paramilitary formations on alert. For more, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gaul.
Today, the former prime minister was discharged from the hospital in Lahore and was shifted to his residence. Before being moved out of the hospital, Imran Khan addressed a press conference. There he announced that he is going to resume this protest march from the same town where he came under this gun attack. From Tuesday, according to Imran Khan, the march will resume. The plan is that this march, when it starts from Wazirabad city where he came under attack, it may take between 10 to 12 days to reach Islamabad. So the garrison city of Rawalpindi next to Islamabad is where he said he will personally join the march when people from all across Pakistan would have gathered by that time. So that's when he plans to lead the march into Islamabad.
What has been the government's reaction?
Well, obviously, the government is trying to boost security in Islamabad. They have already deployed thousands of police and paramilitary forces here in the city, and shipping containers have been placed on main roads in order to block those roads when these protesters try to enter the city, the capital city. So we see the government is trying to boost security, ensure that the marchers are unable to enter the city. Today's press conference, Imran Khan once again repeated his demand for a judicial inquiry into the assassination attempt on him. He has accused Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, the Federal Interior Minister, and a senior officer of the Pakistani military of plotting this attack to kill him. And he has demanded that until all these 3 senior officials step down from their posts, whatever inquiry is held into this attack will not be considered an impartial inquiry.
A lot of analysts saying that former Prime Minister is playing this assassination plot up because he was warned earlier, even before this march to Islamabad, that this was a possibility and he went ahead anyway.
Yes, that's true that he was repeatedly warned that he should create some kind of a bulletproof or bombproof arrangement on the container truck on which he has been leading this march, but he just refused to do so, telling the authorities that because he's a political leader, he's a public figure, and people want to see him, so that's why he decided to go ahead without any secure arrangement. But now we see that when he announced today that he's going to join the marchers in Rawalpindi, which is just adjacent to Islamabad, that clearly shows that he is not planning to lead the march from Wazirabad, which is about 180 kilometers from Islamabad.
That's VOA Asghar speaking with me from Islamabad. Abortion is a key issue heading into U.S. midterm elections this Tuesday after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade decision legalizing abortion. If Republicans take control of the U.S. House and Senate, it could affect international funding for family planning. The U.S. obligates about $600 million annually to international family planning assistance, about half of which goes to African countries. For more on how the outcome of the elections could affect international reproductive health care funding, VOA's Carol Van Dam spoke to Jason Baer, Managing Director of International Affairs and Trade for U.S. General Accounting Office, an independent, nonpartisan agency that works for Congress.
So they do a variety of things. So first, they try to get local partners involved so that it isn't seen as the United States coming and trying to impose any kind of ideals. Second is they do programs that people want, linking it to other kind of health system strengthening. So helping build a clinic in a rural area that provides family planning or reproductive health, as well as other services, may be something that's more of a magnet and helps them get more interest and willingness to do these things. I also mentioned part of what they do is the media outreach campaign. Gotten more sophisticated with how they do these in terms of the media that they're using, and they use people from the local community to be a part of those media campaigns.
Who is responsible for dispensing the healthcare services abroad? How does it actually play out?
So the U.S. government typically has either grants or contracts with non-governmental organizations, kind of a complicated situation in some instances, but there are some relatively large non-governmental organizations that have global operations, and they may subcontract with a local organization to provide these things, but it's not actually U.S. government employees providing any of these services or this assistance. We provide contracts and grants to others to do that.
So I'm not asking you to weigh in on either side, but is USAID concerned that the funding will be cut if there is a change in leadership in Congress after the midterm elections?
I'll start with a little bit of history on this, and then we'll get to maybe a more direct answer on this. But the genesis of this really actually goes back to the 1980s. At the UN Population Conference in Mexico City in the 80s, the Reagan administration announced kind of the first iteration of this policy. And in essence, the policy was that the United States was not going to provide any future family planning or reproductive health assistance to partners, non-governmental organizations, that either supported or performed abortions. And what we've seen over time moving forward from the 1980s is that policy has been implemented and then rescinded depending on the politics of the administration. So in general, Republican administrations have imposed the policy, and then when they come into office, Democratic administrations have rescinded the policy. And we've seen that again probably over the last 40 years. So this policy was last in effect in the previous administration from 2017 until 2021. In the first few weeks, the current administration rescinded that policy.
That's Jason Baer, Managing Director of International Affairs and Trade for the U.S. General Accounting Office, a nonpartisan agency that works for Congress. He was speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam. Americans head to the polls Tuesday to vote in the midterm elections. Over the next few days, VOA Africa will be reporting on the elections. My colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson, recently spoke with VOA executive producer Steve Reddish, who has covered U.S. elections for decades. In this conversation, they discussed the issue of election denialism.
Right now, the definition of an election denier is someone who specifically refuses to accept the outcome of an election. Most recently, the 2020 presidential election. Ex-President Donald Trump claimed there was massive fraud and the election was stolen from him. However, it has not been proven and has been disproved through various different court cases during the after the 2020 election, but he continues to claim that the election was stolen from him, and many Republicans claim the same. They are supporting the ex-president's claim that the election was stolen from him, that there was massive fraud, and that they are denying the election was won by the Democrat Joe Biden. Hence, we have election deniers.
Has this historically been an issue in the United States? Have there been past elections where this has come up, or is this a fairly new development?
Election denialism is a relatively new development in American politics. It really started with the 2020 election and President Trump's claim that the election was fraudulent and that there was so much fraud that the election was stolen from him. In 2018, when Stacey Abrams ran against Brian Kemp for the governor's job in Georgia, Stacey Abrams lost that election. She claimed fraud and never conceded to the governor, to Brian Kemp. She never conceded the race. Did she deny that she won? No, but she never conceded. There's a slight difference there, but that happened in 2018. But for the most part, election denialism is a relatively new thing in American politics, and it really started after the 2020 election, when then-President Donald Trump refused to accept the results of the 2020 election, claimed that there was lots of fraud that kept him from winning, and has refused to concede the election. In fact, he denies that he lost the election. And that's kind of where the phrase election deniers has come from.
That's our colleague Steve Reddish speaking with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson about the U.S. midterm elections. The three-member U.N. Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem and Israel, will begin public hearings on alleged human rights violations in the Palestinian territories in Geneva this week. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The commission chair, South African jurist and former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, will open the hearings Monday, to be followed by live testimony from three witnesses. The next hearings are expected to be held early next year, but not in Geneva. The public hearings will focus on the closure orders and Israel's terrorism designation of several Palestinian non-governmental organizations. It also will explore the events surrounding the West Bank killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in May. Abu Akleh allegedly was killed by Israeli sniper fire. An Israeli investigation into the killing concluded the journalist was most likely killed in unintentional fire from an Israeli soldier who did not know she was a journalist. UN Human Rights Council spokesman Rolando Gomez said during a briefing with reporters that public hearings are being held to clarify these issues. He said both Israelis and Palestinians will testify.
This current commission of inquiry is unique in that it is looking into human rights abuse and violations, alleged human rights abuse and violations in both the occupied Palestinian territory and in Israel. And they are, of course, impartial, independent investigators. So any allegations of bias are absolutely false. They are independent and impartial, and we'll be looking at both sides.
The commission was established in 2001 by the UN Human Rights Council and appointed Pillay, as well as Indian human rights expert Milun Kothari and Australian jurist Christopher Sidoti as members. Gomez said both Israeli and Palestinian witnesses have agreed to be identified and to testify publicly. He said, however, the Israeli government is not participating.
So the Commission of Inquiry has reached out to Israel for its comments and seeking cooperation and access. However, they have not responded. Unfortunately, they have not received that cooperation or access into the occupied Palestinian territory. Palestine, they have cooperated with the commissioners, And have done so since the beginning of their mandate last year.
Gomez said information normally is collected from victims and witnesses privately. Public testimony, though, he said, mitigates speculation and misinformation regarding the work of the commission. What you see is what you get, he said. The commission presented its first report to the UN Human Rights Council in June. The U.S. ambassador to the council, Michelle Taylor, called the report a further demonstration of long-standing disproportionate attention given to Israel in the council and must stop. She said the council should address all human rights concerns, regardless of country, in an even-handed manner. The commission reports to the Human Rights Council and General Assembly annually. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, delegates at the UN COP27 climate summit in Egypt agreed on Sunday to discuss whether rich nations should compensate poor countries most vulnerable to climate change for their suffering. The item was adapted to the agenda in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, as world leaders arrived for the negotiations scheduled to run through November 18th. Much of the tension at COP27 is expected to relate to loss and damage, funds provided by wealthy nations to vulnerable low-income countries that bear little responsibility for climate warming emissions. At COP26 last year in Glasgow, high-income nations blocked a proposal for a loss and damage financing body, instead supporting a three-year dialogue for funding discussions. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Australia can expect another wave of COVID-19 infections in coming weeks, according to experts, as new variants circulate. Coronavirus cases are rising quickly in New South Wales and Victoria, Australia's most populous states. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Public health authorities in the states of New South Wales and Victoria have warned that another surge in infections is approaching. Official data has shown that in the last week of October, coronavirus case numbers increased in all Australian states and territories except Queensland. There were 9,707 positive diagnoses in the week ending October 29 in New South Wales, an 11% increase from the previous week. Government data has shown that more than 95% of Australians aged over 16 have had at least two doses of a COVID-19 vaccine. In a video posted on Twitter Thursday, New South Wales Chief Health Officer Kerry Chant warned of a spike in infections.
By looking at all the local information we have and what's happening overseas, we believe COVID cases will rise in the coming weeks. The protection the New South Wales community has from vaccination and previous infection continues to reduce the risk of severe illness. However, the elderly and those with underlying health conditions will continue to be at higher risk.
COVID-19 continues to spread in other countries. China's COVID-19 cases hit their highest in 2.5 months on Thursday, according to health authorities. The world's most populous nation is following President Xi Jinping's zero COVID policy, which has seen millions of people locked down in major cities. The WHO has said China has had 9,043,760 confirmed coronavirus cases since the pandemic began. In the United States, White House Chief Medical Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci said Thursday that new Omicron variants were gaining ground across the country as winter approaches. Researchers at University College London say Britain could be relatively free of COVID-19 this Christmas, but potentially faces another wave of cases in January. The European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control has said COVID-19 variants BQ1 and BQ1.1 are likely to drive up cases in the months ahead in Europe. As of November 3, there have been more than 628 million confirmed COVID-19 cases globally, including about 6.5 million fatalities reported to the WHO. The WHO said that Niue, a small island in the South Pacific Ocean with a population of 2,000 people, has recorded 85 COVID-19 cases and no fatalities during the pandemic. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday, join us as we put the latest developments into a global context with stories, interviews, and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player. Protests have been growing inside and outside Iran, initially sparked by the death in police custody of Mahsa Amini, a young woman arrested by Iran's morality police for not having her hair fully covered. Each Wednesday, go beyond the breaking news with VOA's Flashpoint Iran. Listen online at voanews.com or in your podcast player.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Ruafo in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has demonstrated its commitment to countering systemic corruption and the Russian government's malign influence campaigns in Moldova by imposing sanctions on 9 individuals and 12 entities. The sanctioned individuals and entities include oligarchs widely recognized for capturing and corrupting Moldova's political and economic institutions, and those acting as Russian instruments seeking to manipulate the United States and its allies and partners, including Moldova and Ukraine. These sanctions expose not only Russia's covert strategy in Moldova, but also demonstrate how corruption undermines the rule of law, said Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Brian Nelson. The Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, designated Vladimir Plahotniuk, a former government official involved in corruption. Plahotniuk's bribery of law enforcement officials reflected his long-standing efforts to capture and corrupt Moldova's judicial and law enforcement institutions, while using his wealth and political influence to undermine political rivals and rule of law in the country. The State Department imposed visa restrictions on Plahotniuk in January 2020 for his involvement in significant corruption. As part of that action, Plahotniuk and his immediate family members are generally ineligible for entry to the United States. OFAC also designated Ilan Shor, leader of the Shor Party, for being responsible for directly or indirectly engaging in interference in a foreign government election for the benefit of the Russian government. A beneficiary of a large-scale 2014 money laundering scheme related to the theft of $1 billion from Moldovan banks, Shor has worked with other corrupt oligarchs and Moscow-based entities to create political unrest in Moldova and sought to undermine Moldova's bid for EU membership. OFAC designated 7 additional individuals and 12 entities that have been involved in the Kremlin's attempts to interfere in Moldova's elections. Russia has sought to advance its own interests by providing illicit financing, including funds earmarked for bribes and electoral fraud, to support pro-Kremlin political activity in Moldova. According to Undersecretary Nelson, Russian influence operations attempt to exploit weaknesses in target countries in order to destabilize them from within. These designations reaffirm the U.S. commitment to tackling corruption as a first-order national security threat and to promoting accountability for malign actors who seek to undermine Moldova's democratic institutions and elections. The United States will continue to impose costs on those threatening democracy abroad.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.